Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature two essays which originated on the internet and which have been adapted as radio presentations. Both essays discuss the 2004 American elections. The first is an essay by Sarah Anderson published on the Common Dreams website entitled 10 Reasons Not to Move to Canada. The second is a column by political organizer Ted Glick entitled 4 More Years. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. Florida voters increase Florida's minimum wage. Big business is eager over a Bush win. Some Texas textbooks are slated to reflect anti-gay, anti-safe-sex attitudes. And we'll recap the results you might have missed from last week's elections. Florida voters overwhelmingly approved a measure increasing the minimum wage from $5.15 to $6.15 on Election Day. The new minimum wage will be implemented in 6 months and will be adjusted every September by the rate of inflation. Proponents of the measure said 300,000 workers will be directly affected, and an additional 500,000 will eventually see a pay raise due to the ripple effect of increasing wages for the state's lowest earners. Republican Governor Jeb Bush opposed the measure, claiming it would lead to the loss of jobs, health care coverage, and retirement benefits. But studies have not found the link between minimum wage increases and significant job losses. A full-time worker paid the current $5.15 minimum wage makes $10,712 a year, 28% below the 2003 federal poverty threshold for a family of three. Industries are looking forward to the possible perks of a second Bush term, expressing hope that Bush will allow private investment of Social Security funds and postpone government-mandated price controls for drugs, according to the Associated Press. Barbara Ryan, a pharmaceuticals analyst and managing director at Deutsche Bank Securities, told the AP that prescription drug pricing will continue to be determined solely by demand, a system that consumer advocates say hurts low- and middle-income people. The defense industry and businesses connected to oil drilling in the Alaskan wilderness also stand to benefit from huge contracts and a renewed push for Alaskan drilling. In addition, Bush's proposed increase in medical savings accounts for individuals could be a bonanza for banks and investment firms who manage the funds. The Texas Board of Education has approved new health textbooks that specifically define marriages between one man and one woman and focus on abstinence-only sex education. The decision comes after the board pressured the publishers to change what one board member referred to as asexual stealth phrases in favor of more gender-specific language, reports the Associated Press. At the board's request, publishers Glencoe McGraw-Hill and Holt Reinhardt & Winston changed the phrases married partners to husband and wife. According to the AP, Holt Reinhardt & Winston included the definition of marriage as a lifelong union between a husband and wife, while Glencoe McGraw-Hill changed when two people marry to when a man and woman marry, and partners to husbands and wives. The board also chose textbooks that all but leave out contraception as an option for preventing pregnancy or sexually transmitted diseases. According to Reuters, 3 out of 4 approved texts fail to mention contraception at all, while one only mentions condoms in passing. The board's critics said that in addition to putting teens at risk, the decision may violate state regulations, which require sex education curriculum to include information about contraception. Board members countered that the books were satisfactory because information about contraceptives is included in teaching supplements or teachers' editions. Despite predictions of widespread polling irregularities and voter suppression, and hopes that an unusually large turnout would favor the candidacy of Senator John Kerry, the Democratic candidate has officially conceded defeat to President George W. Bush. To the surprise of many, the presidential vote of nearly all 50 states went to the candidate whose party technically won that state in 2000, with the exception of New Hampshire, which actually turned in favor of Kerry. Nevertheless, due to a population shift in the Electoral College favoring Bush's so-called red states, The margin of electoral votes will prove even greater than that of 2000, even despite the migration of New Hampshire's 4 votes to the Kerry camp. Kerry maintained solid support throughout the northeastern states and dominated the whole west coast, but he obtained many of those states by narrower than expected margins. Meanwhile, Bush carried victory in some states by a much larger gap than had been projected. By about 1 o'clock a.m. on election night, it was becoming apparent that Ohio would favor Bush by a small but significant margin. And while some voters were reportedly standing in line as late as 3 a.m., the major networks began putting Ohio on Bush's list once 93% of the key state's results were reported. Ballots across the country considered statewide candidates and initiatives, the results of which also generally reflected a rightward shift. With the exception of governor's races, 6 out of 11 of which appear to have seated Democrats, Republicans shifted the balance of power further in their favor, increasing their majorities in both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, while decisively winning initiatives against the rights of gays, women's, and felons. Voters in 11 states supported the constitutional amendments that in one way or another disenfranchise same-sex couples from achieving the right to legally marry. The adult population of Florida approved a state constitutional amendment permitting lawmakers to ban women younger than 18 years old from terminating their own pregnancies without express permission from their parents. Californians narrowly voted down an initiative that would have required most employers to pay 80% of workers' health insurance packages. Also in California, voters defeated a ballot initiative proposing to moderate that state's indiscriminate three strikes law, which mandates sentences of 25 years to life for all three-time felons, including those convicted of nonviolent crimes. The Montana electorate made their state the 10th to legalize marijuana for medicinal purposes, but Oregonians chose not to do so, and voters in Alaska opted to uphold and enforce current marijuana laws. In Colorado, voters dashed the hopes of some that the state would become one of the few to allocate its electoral college votes proportionate to the popular vote. In the short run, that initiative would have favored Democratic presidential candidates, who could earn up to 4 electoral votes without actually winning the largely Republican state. In Arizona, the anti-immigrant Proposition 200 won easily. The initiative's actual scope is unknown, however, as there was disagreement between supporters and opponents on the exact reach of the vaguely worded measure. Its supporters claim that only welfare benefits would become off-limits, while opponents believe the law could apply to many other public services, such as police protection, healthcare, and libraries. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle narrowly but soundly lost his seat to Republican challenger John Thune, leaving the Democratic leadership in that body up for grabs. Daschle's defeat marks the first time either party has unseated a Senate leader since 1952. In a barely contested Senate race, Democrat Barack Obama resoundingly defeated Alan Keyes to become only the 3rd African-American senator since Reconstruction. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard, on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchik. This is the first of 2 essays which will feature on today's show. This essay by Sarah Anderson was published on the Common Dreams website and is entitled 10 Reasons Not to Move to Canada. Ready to screw this country and buy a one-way ticket north? Here are some reasons to stay in the belly of the beast. Number 1, the rest of the world. After the February 2003 anti-war protests, the New York Times described the global peace movement as the world's second superpower, Their actions didn't prevent the war, but protesters in 9 countries have succeeded in pressuring their governments to pull their troops from Iraq and/or withdraw from the so-called Coalition of the Willing. Anti-war Americans owe it to the majority of the people on this planet who agree with them to stay and do what they can to end the suffering in Iraq and prevent future preemptive wars. Number 2, people power can trump presidential power. The strength of social movements can be more important than whoever is in the White House. Example, in 1970, President Nixon supported the Occupational Safety and Health Act, widely considered the most important pro-worker legislation of the last 50 years. It didn't happen because Nixon loved labor unions, but because union power was strong. Stay and help build the peace, economic justice, environmental, and other social movements that can make change. Number 3. The great strides made in voter registration and youth mobilization must be built on rather than abandoned. Number 4. Like Nicaraguans in the 1980s, Iraqis need U.S. allies. After Ronald Reagan was elected in 1984, progressives resisted the urge to flee northwards and instead stayed to fight the U.S. government's secret war of arming the Contras in Nicaragua and supporting human rights atrocities throughout Central America. Iraq is a different scenario, but we can still learn from the U.S. Central America solidarity work that exposed illegal U.S. activities and their brutal consequences, and ultimately prevailed by forcing a change in policy. Number 5. We can't let up on the free trade front. Activists have held the Bush administration at bay on some issues. On trade, opposition in the United States and in developing countries has largely blocked the Bush administration's corporate-driven trade agenda for 4 years. The president is expected to soon appoint a new top trade negotiator to break the impasse. Whoever he picks would love to see a progressive exodus to Canada. Number 6. Barack Obama. His victory to become the only African-American in the U.S. Senate was one of the few bright spots of the election. An early opponent of the Iraq War, Obama trounced his primary and general election opponents, even in white rural districts, showing he could teach other progressives a few things about broadening their base. As David Moberg of In These Times put it, Obama demonstrates how a progressive politician can redefine mainstream political symbols to expand support for liberal policies and politicians rather than engage in creeping capitulation to the right. Number 7. Saying so long to the DLC. Barry Goldwater suffered a resounding defeat when he ran for president against Lyndon Johnson in 1964, but his campaign spawned a conservative movement that eventually gained control of the Republican Party and elected Ronald Reagan in 1980. Progressives should see the excitement surrounding Dean, Kucinich, Mosley, Braun, and Sharpton during the primary season as the foundation for a similar takeover of the Democratic Party. Number 8, 2008. President Bush is entering his second term facing an escalating casualty rate in Iraq, a record trade deficit, a staggering budget deficit, sky-high oil prices, and a deeply divided nation. As the Republicans face likely failure, progressives need to start preparing for regime change in 2008 or sooner. Remember that Nixon was re-elected with a bigger margin than Bush, but faced impeachment within a year. Number 9. Americans are not all yahoos. Although I wouldn't attempt to convince a Frenchman of it right now, many surveys indicate that Americans are more internationalist than the election results might suggest. In a September poll by the University of Maryland, majorities of Bush supporters expressed support for multilateral approaches to security, including the United States being part of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, 68%, the International Criminal Court, 75%, the Treaty Banning Landmines, 66%, and the Kyoto Treaty on Climate Change, 54%. The problem is that most of these Bush supporters weren't aware that Bush opposed these positions. Stay and help turn progressive instincts into political power. Number 10, winter. Average January temperature in Ottawa, 12.2 degrees Fahrenheit. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth. This is the second of two essays on today's show. It's part of a regular column called Future Hope, written on November 3, 2004 by political organizer Ted Glick, entitled Four More Years. One of the first thoughts I had today after I learned that Kerry was conceding to Bush was of something the late Dave Dellinger once said. I was with him in a group that was on a hunger strike in the summer of 1972, protesting the escalation of the war on Vietnam. At the time, Democratic presidential and peace candidate George McGovern was going down in the polls, and war president Richard Nixon was pulling way ahead. A number of us were very concerned about what Nixon's re-election would mean for the Vietnamese. Dave's input was to the effect that what happened with the Democrats and Republicans was ultimately not that important. What was important was the strength and vitality of the independent movements and organizations, like the peace movement. If they were strong enough, they could eventually force whoever was in office to change course. And 6 months later, following Nixon's re-election, the Christmas bombings of North Vietnam and the shooting down of many B-52s, the Nixon administration decided they had had enough. 1 month later, on January 27, 1973, a peace agreement was negotiated and signed with the Vietnamese, and the U.S. began its withdrawal from all of Indochina. I've thought of Dave's words more than once over the last many months as I've worked to help get the Bushites out of office. But since I've been working to strengthen the peace movement, the radical justice movement, and the Green Party as my approach to the anti-Bush work, I've not felt too conflicted. Today, however, I must admit that the thought fleetingly crossed my mind that perhaps my decades-long commitment to using the electoral arena to help advance the cause of justice and peace has been misplaced. It's not just that Bush won and that the Republicans picked up additional seats in the House and Senate. It's also that the Green Party and other third-party campaigns, including Nader's, did not fare well as far as total votes for their presidential and vice presidential tickets. Maybe, I found myself thinking, I should put my energies into another kind of organizing for social change. I've also been wondering what it was that lost it for Kerry. One reason could be that his pro-war, pro-corporate, Democratic Leadership Council-type politics didn't exactly motivate young people to come out and vote. Initial reports indicate that there was little change in the percentage of young voters in 2004 as compared to 2000. If true, this is huge. The voter registration effort among young people was one of the reasons why many people were optimistic that Kerry could win. Another possible culprit, of course, is extensive voter intimidation, disenfranchisement, partisanship, and structural racism in the way our electoral system functions. And how can it be that exit polls showed Kerry in the lead by several percentage points at midday, and by the end of the evening, he's behind by several percentage points? Weren't those electronic voting machines pre-programmed after all, and will we ever know if they were or weren't? Certainly the anti-marriage equality referendums on 11 state ballots, including Ohio's, helped to bring out the conservative evangelicals and fundamentalists who make up Bush's base vote. This may have neutralized reported anxiety among that constituency over his statement in an ABC interview a week before the election that he personally supported civil unions despite a Republican Party platform that opposed them. It will be interesting to see analyses of how many low-income people voted. Kerry's campaign rhetoric was all about watching your back for middle-class people, but very infrequently about raising the boats at the bottom. And if Kerry did much outreach to inner-city blacks and Latinos, it sure didn't get much coverage in the news I saw. I know that he very rarely addressed their issues in a substantive and direct way. And so now we have to prepare ourselves, psychologically, emotionally, politically, and organizationally, for 4 more years of the same group of dangerous neoconservative fools who've been messing things up for the last 4 years. It's not the end of the world. There are major obstacles in the way of the Bushites. A war in Iraq that is going very badly. Reports just before the election indicated that even Colin Powell was telling friends that he believes his government is losing. Serious economic problems, from the high price of oil to massive foreign debt to the growing weakness of the dollar compared to other currencies to the huge budget deficit. The growing strength of the left in Latin America, as reflected by recent victories in elections in Venezuela, Uruguay, Brazil, and Chile, to go with popular movements that have recently ousted pro-IMF governments in Bolivia and Argentina. The nearly half of the electorate who voted against Bush and Cheney, many of whom will continue to feel strongly about their positions on issues. These feelings are not going away, and neither are most, if not all, of the organizations that have developed over the last several years in opposition to the Bush agenda. And finally, a shaky electoral coalition that includes Christian fundamentalists and moderate pro-choice Republicans. There are very real conflicts and divisions within the Republican Party that cannot be wished away, and that will make themselves felt as the Bushites attempt to move their regressive agenda. There are a number of prominent conservatives like Pat Buchanan who are vocal about their opposition to the Iraq War and other Bush policies. What is key, what is absolutely essential, is that those of us who have been actively building the peace movement, The global justice movement, the racial justice movement, democratic trade unions, strong community organizations, the Green Party, the Labor Party, and other third-party groups, women's, student, youth, and LGBT organizations, all of us need to keep our heads up, our minds clear, and our hearts strong. We are needed, desperately needed, right now, and we can't let down those in this country and around the world who are depending on us to fight these bastards. In the words of Joe Hill, don't mourn, organize. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.